This is not going to be a glancing blow. This is not going to be a tropical storm. This is not going to be, one of those storms that hit and move out to sea. This is going to be a Mike Tyson punch to the Carolina coast.
Hurricane Florence is knocking on North Carolina's door, powered by dangerous winds of more than 100 miles per hour. The storm was downgraded from a Category 4 to a Category 3 on Wednesday and then down again to a Category 2 overnight. But Florence is still expected to cause catastrophic flooding and deadly conditions, and it's expected to make landfall later tonight or early Friday. In preparation for the worst, many across the Carolinas and Virginia are packing up and leaving. But for some, evacuating homes and cities is virtually impossible.
We tell them you should go. They can hear that message. They can rationally understand the need to leave. But if they don't have a vehicle and they use public transportation, or they don't have a vehicle that is dependable enough to travel the distances they need to travel, or they don't have enough money to put fuel in the tank, those are some very real considerations.
So what happens to the most vulnerable people when the storm hits? I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. That's where we start the show today. It's not just people living in poverty, or even those who can't afford to evacuate their homes. It can also mean those living with chronic illness or disabilities.
In the past, we've seen many, many problems with hospitals and nursing homes after storms.
Sherry Fink is a correspondent at the New York Times and has reported extensively on how hurricanes can ravage healthcare facilities. She wrote a book about what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina called 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital.
Hurricane Katrina is sort of the touch point. In that case, Memorial Medical Center, for example, which I ended up writing a book about, got so desperate. It was surrounded by water, like many American hospitals that are in flood zones. Its electrical systems were not protected against flooding. And so they were in danger of losing all power. They had to decide which patients to put on helicopters first. And then they did lose all power, and things became so desperate that later, a doctor and two nurses were arrested and accused of having killed their patients. They were not indicted, but in fact, some of the hospital staff who I interviewed talked about giving patients medicines like morphine and fast-acting sedatives to try to hasten their deaths because they felt that the situation was so desperate. So that's a very extreme example, but we've seen much more recently terrible problems in healthcare institutions. I mean, in Hurricane Sandy in New York City, where there were many hospitals and nursing homes that had to be evacuated because they stayed in place as the storm came, and then they lost power, to last year in Hurricane Irma in Florida, where in one single nursing home that was just without power for a prolonged period, a dozen patients died from the heat.
And Sherry says we have to keep learning from past storms.
This poses a really difficult problem for healthcare institutions. If they're not prepared, if they don't have systems like generators and electrical systems up high, if they don't have their own sources of water, they can get into quite a desperate situation. On the other hand, and you saw playing out the last few days, this whole decision about whether you evacuate a healthcare institution ahead of a storm is also a tricky one because that involves a lot of risk for patients. It is, of course, expensive for the healthcare institutions themselves. And we never know exactly where the storm is going to hit.
Sherry Fink of the New York Times. She's currently in the South Atlantic reporting on Florence. But hospitals are only one piece of making sure no one gets left behind. Mark Burtis is a former director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Shelby County, Ohio, and now an emergency management consultant. And he spends a lot of time thinking about how cities and states do and should help disadvantaged people escape harm's way. Burtis says we need to be thinking a lot more about the inclusiveness of emergency planning.
When you get a team together to write an emergency plan, you look around the room and you assume everyone has the exact same capabilities as you. And then you write a plan for what you know most, your own conditions. So if someone told you you need to evacuate, you would think, okay, well, I have this vehicle or I have this larger vehicle. I can fit more of my pictures, more of my photos, more of the things that I want to save. And we'll get in a car and we'll drive somewhere. But that's not the case for a large portion of Americans. And I would say in the past couple of years is where we've really in the emergency management community started trying to change the way that we plan.
Right. And I think and then there's the different populations that we're looking at outside of accessibility to transportation, which is obviously a critical part of being able to evacuate. There are those who just cannot leave. And I'm thinking specifically of those who are in hospitals, medical facilities, and even in prisons, which has been a major concern, I think, particularly when it comes to South Carolina. Do you have any thoughts on those specific groups?
So one of the problems with planning for those specific groups is that, especially with a storm this large, this storm, the path is wobbling. So it looks like it's going to hit North Carolina on the South Carolina border, but then stall. So we have finite resources in this country for evacuation. If we need to evacuate someone from a long-term care facility or a hospital who's medically vulnerable, it's just dangerous to even consider moving some people who are on long-term medical devices and attached to the need for power or clean water for dialysis. And the thought of moving them, just that transportation alone, increases their risk of something bad happening. So we have specialized units that can move those, but we don't have enough to evacuate 2 states worth of hospitals of those medically fragile people, even if we confine it to the coastlines. The prisoners, incarcerated individuals, they are at risk. And I do know that some of the prisons are evacuating, but sometimes they restrict those. The Department of Corrections will do the review and say, this portion of the prison is strong enough, we're just going to evacuate this portion. But, I mean, we're at capacity at many prisons in this country. And so then now we're going to create an overcrowding condition at a different prison. And the concerns that planners like myself were talking about with prison officials, Department of Corrections officials, is the if we move them there, now the power companies just told us that we may lose power for up to a couple weeks in areas. Are we overcrowding a prison now? And now we have the potential for a long-term power outage. Are we making those conditions worse? And so it's really a fundamental wicked problem that has a lot of variables that are discussed. And we do a poor job of funding emergency preparedness in this country.
What do you think is driving that, though, Mark? There's been a lot of talk today, and we'll be talking about this in our next segment, about some money that's being diverted to ICE away from FEMA, for example. So there are lots of, conversations happening about those dollars. But at the broader level, what do you think is driving the lack of preparedness? We are now in, we've had Katrina, we've had Sandy, we've had, hurricanes are not a surprise to us anymore. Why are we still struggling?
Part of the problem, I believe, is that if you're not directly impacted by it, it's the drama that you see on TV. It looks bad, but then the news cycle changes focus. And there's so much occurring in the news it doesn't impact people that I know. And when we talk about, like, did you see what happened in Puerto Rico? I can tell you that some people that I have acquaintances with are like, I didn't realize it was that bad, unless it impacts you. And then the cameras move on and we forget that those people are still rebuilding.
So we mentioned being able to evacuate, and I'm wondering if there are moments where particularly low-income Americans, those who other vulnerable populations like people who don't speak English, for example, you mentioned hourly workers. What are the specific things that could impact these populations in terms of trying to evacuate during a storm?
So one of the first things that we have to realize is our populations are diverse. And so I know in Franklin County, Ohio, they do a good job of putting out all of their preparedness information and the response information in real time in Somali, which sounds weird for the Midwest and in middle of Ohio, but they have realized that they have a large Somali population. And so they work with that Somali community to make sure that what they're saying in English gets translated into a meaningful message in Somali. It's not as easy as going out to Google and just having the Google Translate. The meaning has to be received appropriately and realizing who's in our community. For far too long, we had people sitting at a desk planning for people who look like them and who had the capabilities and the resources that they have. Once we adopted a whole community mindset, we need to be bringing those other partners, and we have groups. So if we can't bring impoverished people to the table to plan for us, we have stakeholders in the community and community people working on their behalf in groups that are looking out for individual pockets of they're on the edge when it comes to a response. They day to day, they live on a financial edge that some of us can't imagine. And then we tell them you should evacuate. And if they go to Expedia and look, and well, every hotel in Charlotte, which seems to be a safe distance away from the coast, is at least $100, then it's going to take $60 in gas if I can even get the gas in the car, assuming that my car is running well enough. And then now will they take my pets? And that's an additional expense sometimes. And we're asking them to do stuff that they have no financial means to do. A couple years ago, the Federal Reserve put out that study that said 47% of Americans can't come up with $400 if they need it. Well, I think a weekend away at a hotel or at a shelter, even to get somewhere else, is quickly going to run up over $400.
Mark, give us a sense of what can be done. I mean, we're having this conversation, you know, as I'm watching Florence on the news sort of, you know, make its way towards the mainland United States here, towards the Carolinas. There are about three storms behind Florence that could be tropical storms. We don't know yet. What can be done in the short term to help folks who do need to evacuate or these vulnerable populations?
So in the short term, it is really tough 3 days to affect an evacuation if you haven't done much planning for it. And having deals and memorandums of agreement already in place with the Amtraks and the local metro busing systems and school buses, the problem with those are, again, that you're going to have an acknowledgement by those bus drivers that they're going to stay behind, that they become essential emergency workers in a hurricane. And that may not be a job that routinely sees that. We will have a lot of first responders staying in station houses. We will have a lot of ambulance drivers staying in their stations. And it's these people are voluntarily staying behind in the aftermath, just so that they're available as soon as possible.
Mark Burtis is a former director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Shelby County, Ohio, and currently an emergency management consultant. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So how are you preparing for Hurricane Florence?
This is Jody. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I volunteer with the Red Cross. I'm in Wilmington making sure there are nurses caring for the people who have evacuated to the shelters all along the coast in North Carolina.
This is Mary Claire from Goose Creek, South Carolina. This is not our first rodeo. We are well prepared and have everything we need. God bless everybody in the path of the storm. I wish us all safety.
Hi, my name is Denise, and I'm with Dots Place Animal Haven in Seneca, South Carolina. Right now, we're working to get some of the municipal shelters on the coast, get the animals out of there, because many of those are in low-lying and flooding areas. So we're bringing all of our rescue dogs into our home.
Hi, this is Orin from Atlanta, Georgia. My parents live in Myrtle Beach. They're evacuating to come stay with me in my studio apartment for a whole week. Yay, hurricane.
And thanks for sharing your Hurricane Florence preparation plans and helping others in your communities as well. Keep your stories coming our way at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and please stay safe. On Tuesday night, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley released budget documents that showed the Department of Homeland Security transferred $10 million from FEMA's budget in June to help pay for ICE migration detention efforts.
Just as hurricane season is starting, because it generally starts June 1st, the administration is working hard to find funds for additional detention camps. And of course, this is all part of the child separation policy. And that's how this information came into my hands.
That was the Democratic senator on the Rachel Maddow show. And although FEMA is disputing that any money has been diverted from actual response efforts to child detention efforts, you can still hear the senator's sense of alarm.
$10 million comes out of FEMA when we're facing a hurricane season, knowing what happened last year, and then look what we've had since. A hurricane just barely missed Hawaii, a tropical storm that almost became a hurricane hit Mississippi, and now we have this hurricane, Florence, bearing down on the Carolinas. I find it extraordinary.
Here to explain is Ron Nixon. He's the Homeland Security Correspondent for the New York Times. Ron, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So there are a couple of competing claims here in this story. We have DHS denying the allegation that the money came from FEMA, and then we have FEMA saying something else. So to help us understand the two sides here.
So DHS is saying that the money came from FEMA, but that it did not come from the disaster fund that is used to deal with hurricanes and fires and earthquakes and the like.
So can I ask you a question right there?
Sure.
FEMA,
sure.
I would assume that all the money in FEMA is meant for disaster recovery.
Not necessarily. So FEMA, you know, like every other agency, has a budget for staffing, and they have administrative for, you know, support for like the office and things like that. So and they're public affairs people. So that's where the money appears to be coming from, according to the budget documents that were released. So they specifically said, no, it did not come from the disaster relief fund, which is about $25 billion. And that's true if you look at the budget docs.
So here's the big question that I've had as we were talking about this. Why take any money away from FEMA, number one? Number two, couldn't those funds, let's say they're not used for administrative support, couldn't those funds, particularly as we sit here and look, stare down Florence, and there are three or four other storms that could be brewing out in the Atlantic, we're deep in the heart of hurricane season, wouldn't it have been made more sense to say, let's take this $10 million and really direct it towards directed emergency response efforts on the ground instead of giving it to ICE?
Right. So two parts question there. So the first part of it is why money at all? One, for that, this is not something that is that unusual. It happens all the time where federal agencies will reprogram money, as they call it, from one thing to another. It happens under all administrations. And again, in that regard, it's not that unusual. Department of Homeland Security, as you can see from that chart, they actually moved $200 million in total from other programs at DHS to ICE and its detention and removal operations. So in that regard, it's not that unusual. Now, regarding your questions like why take any money at all, this is something that they felt that they have these priorities, presidential priorities, in terms of cracking down on illegal immigration. So the idea was to take pieces of money from all of these different places and put it in what they think is their biggest priority, which is getting rid of, you know, these people that they're saying in a country that's illegal and that they're trying to enforce the laws and the like. You know, in the larger scheme of things, $10 million is, you know, out of a budget of billions is not that much. I think it's more of the optics that this transfer happened at the beginning of hurricane season, and it comes on the heels of, you know, what the agency, what FEMA itself said was, you know, somewhat chaotic response in Puerto Rico. So again, I think the optics of it, particularly since you're, you know, a little less than 2 months out from the midterms, really is the optics are bad.
And of course, you know, we should also be mindful of the fact that Americans of all political stripes are impacted by disasters like this.
That's correct.
Ron Nixon is a Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times. Ron, thanks again.
Thank you.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Venture capitalism. It's how companies like Uber and Airbnb get funding to go from being just an idea to being a multi-billion-dollar powerhouse. But here's the thing. The venture capitalists deciding who gets their money are overwhelmingly white and male. And the people who get the money are also overwhelmingly white and male. But there are people who want to change that. And one of them is Arlen Hamilton. She's Black and queer, and she's made it her mission to grant funding to startups with founders who are women, people of color, or LGBT through her own firm, Backstage Capital. And her success there? She's about to launch a $36 million fund called It's About Damn Time, has landed her on the cover of the October issue of Fast Company. And she's here in the studio with me. Arlen, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, no small feat here. You are on the October cover of Fast Company. How does that feel?
It is absolutely surreal. It's been very emotional for me because it just, there are so many times where I didn't know if what I was doing was going to lead to anything. And wow, what a way to show that it has in some way.
And let's talk a little bit about your story, because I feel like when I hear stories like this, we think about, one of our producers had a fantastic way of putting it, the garage myth, you know, about this, like, you started from nothing and you slept in, but now you're getting emotional.
it's residual of seeing the cover and just flooded with memories.
Flooded with the
journey here.
Which included, I think, sleeping in some airports. Is that right?
Yeah, I slept in the San Francisco airport for many nights, just out of necessity. I didn't have anywhere to go to sleep, and it was the safest place I could think of.
Arlen, I want a lot of things. I know we all do, but I don't think I want anything that badly. I'm serious. I don't know if I could sleep on an airport floor. So tell me, what was the driver behind that? And why was venture capitalism the thing that really made you have to do things like that?
Yeah, it was something I signed up for. So I always want to lead with that because I don't want anyone to feel bad for me. I signed up for it. I just had no money. I had maybe $12 in my bank account when I started looking into starting a fund. And the reason I started the fund was because I saw the discrepancies between the amount of capital that was going to straight white men and everyone else in the startup world. To me, venture capital had the most landscape to change a little bit for the better, to introduce more diversity to. It also had the most potential for upside, in my view, for everyone involved, because it is the sliver of the private equity asset class that is supposed to be for the most innovation and the most risk. And so when I looked at how things were a few years ago, I knew that something had to be a complete jolt. I thought, if I'm going to do something and be part of this movement that was, I knew was already starting, it has to be pretty bold, and we absolutely are bullish on the underrepresented, underestimated founders. And for us, that includes women across the board, people of color, and LGBTQ founders. So that's who we focus on the most. You know, starting from scratch, I wanted to have a really clear vision of what I wanted, and I said, what am I? I said, well, I'm a Black gay woman. And every day I walk down the street as all of those things intersectionally, and they each affect me in some way, and I'm very proud of all of them. So I know a lot of people who are starting companies or who have started companies and were around way before I was, and who just aren't getting the attention or the access to resources and capital that others may be getting.
And that's also a historical issue, I think, for communities of color in the United States generally. Not only do we not have access, and not just communities of color, but women, et cetera, but when you really look at wealth in the United States, not income, but wealth.
Yes.
I always say the most important color in this country tends to be green. Mm. And women of color have about $0 to $5 of average wealth. Mm-hmm. Individually. Do you see this as a potential tool to try and build wealth among women and among communities of color?
I do. I don't think I've gotten it figured out yet, but I know that this is where we start. This is the work that I can do to where we start, because I'm fascinated and almost obsessed with the idea of generational wealth for people of color, especially. It's just, it's simple. You know, we haven't had it. So it's something that we absolutely deserve, and we deserve it for ourselves. We deserve to want that for ourselves. And I think that in being a catalyst and building companies, and some of those companies going on to, you know, be worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, you're talking about thousands of jobs being created. You're talking about hundreds or thousands of wealthy people being created from the equity in that. Hopefully that's the plan, you know, that's the goal. And you're also talking about a mind shift, because what I see too is people come up to me and not only are looking for that check that day, but there are people who are saying to me, Black women and Latinx women, saying, I didn't even know, you know, some way or another saying, I didn't even know that I like had the permission to start a company. You know, you asked about venture capital. Why venture capital? It's a means to an end to me, because I have a vision of what I would love the world to look like.
What is that? What's your vision?
It's kind of idealistic, but, you know, I just really see people working together across all stripes and creeds, and all of us thriving, you know, or having the potential to thrive. And I imagine this world where, you know, maybe like a young white male child is being brought up to say, hey, I would love to be like Jessica Matthews, who is a brilliant portfolio company CEO of ours, who is a Black woman, right? That kind of switch where we automatically are, you know, I want to be Bill Gates. Like, wouldn't it be awesome if people's heroes were of all stripes?
Speaking of heroes, I'm just taking a bit of a turn here. We've been talking on the show, on The Takeaway, we've been talking about women in anger and women in rage.
Okay, yes.
You know, and we've especially talked about women of color and anger and rage.
Uh-huh.
This is in the news this week, given our latest example of Serena Williams's fouls, if you will, according to The Empire. What do you have to say about these stereotypes when we talk about women? And these are mostly, a lot of this is also directed at professional women of color. Mm-hmm. So, like, as a Black woman yourself, I can tell you my own stereotypes. But as you see this story unfold, what are your thoughts on
that? I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this. I have been called intimidating since I was in the fourth or fifth grade. I was taller than most of the kids. I wasn't afraid then to speak my mind. I asked a lot of questions. People have clutched their purses as I walk by. I'm kind of a bigger, you know, woman. The reason, you know, and I know a lot of people have said it, it really hit home for so many of us. So many of us were Serena Williams that night. So many of us. I was yelling at my screen, because I was yelling back at so many people, so many men who have tried to put me in my place, when they certainly have done the exact same thing, or even more so, haven't had the guts to do that, to speak up for themselves. And Serena, she is the reason millions of people watch tennis. She is the reason that tennis is relevant right now. And to chastise her and put and have this double, triple, whatever standard for her was absolutely a dressing down.
Is there a standard that you encounter that's similar in the world of finance, the world of venture capital, the world, because these are places, as on the tennis court, where you have to be aggressive?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I
kind of, there was a crossroads for me early on where I had to decide, am I going to play nice and like sort of dull myself down and not be my true self, or am I going to be myself at the risk of offending someone? And very quickly I realized I either do this as myself or not at all. And I think that that is 100% of the reason that things like the cover of Fast Company have happened, things like the 100 investments that we've made have been able to happen. If I were shy, demure, I don't think I would have gotten the deals that I have gotten. I don't think I would have made the strides that I've made. Not to say that that is not those are not qualities that are positive qualities. They are also positive. But in a room where most of the time I'm the only black person or the only woman or both, and usually the only gay person that's out, I have to be 100% me. And I think that it has absolutely, in many cases, intimidated some people. But I'll do that every time.
What do you see, as we wind up, what do you see is the most important financial or economic issue or thing that women of color, gay women of color, women across the board need to be thinking about in this country?
Oh, I ownership, you know, equity. But actually, someone on my team, Amaya, posted something from the NAACP that I read the other day, and it was from maybe the 60s or 70s, and it said, don't buy from a place that would not hire you. I think that's going to be something that really drives me over the next few months and in years, and thinking about that. Where do I put my dollars? And we're very powerful. Women of color are the backbone of the country. We drive culture in the U.S., which drives culture around the world. We're more powerful than we think we are and that we know we are. And that, you know, I'm going to really, I may even change my ideal world is, you know, us on top, us winning.
Arlen Hamilton is a venture capitalist. Arlen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's been nearly 17 years since the United States government turned its focus towards Afghanistan. To date, the U.S. has spent more than $800 billion on the war. All of this has impacted Afghans on the ground, living day to day in the middle of conflict. Ali Latifi is a journalist in Kabul.
I mean, I left when I was young, and then the first time I came back was in 2011, and I moved back officially in 2013. But what I can say is that the situation is basically progressively getting worse in terms of security and the economy. There has been a lot of development. There has been a lot of changes, a lot of positive things that have come. I think we have to give credit to that. But the problem is that just when you think, you know, things couldn't possibly get worse, that new kinds of attacks couldn't take place or new kinds of targets couldn't come up, they are. I mean, in, I can't remember if it was in 2015 or 2016, there was an attack on a neighborhood in Kabul at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I remember going to that neighborhood the next morning, and I remember talking to people in that area, and they said, we used to think we would be safe at home when we were asleep. And now we know that we're not even safe in our sleep. And so people thought that that was sort of like, you know, that's as bad as it could get. And then you saw, you know, a truck bomb that killed more than 150 people last year. You see attacks on protests, attacks on schools, on mosques, on, you know, wrestling gyms, the types of places no one would expect.
You know, we're doing this segment because it's been 17 years, as you are well aware, since the U.S. invasion after 9/11. What impact specifically has that had on the country?
I think it really divided the country in terms of economics. And as we know, like, economics is something that drives so much of any given country, right? And I think we've had a situation where I like to put it kind of like bluntly as the haves and the have-nots. So the haves are the usual types of people who profit from war and interventions and things like that. So that's politicians, that's NGO workers, that's media outlets, people trying to work on reconstruction, who have made tons and tons of money off of this country, both Afghan and foreign. And then you have the average people. And amongst sort of like the average person, you know, you had some people who in the beginning years of the invasion, they were working with these NGOs and these media outlets and these embassies and these government offices, and they were making considerable amounts of money. And then in 2013, as all that started to dry up, sorted their lives. You know, they spent all of that money. There was never anyone telling them or reminding them that this money would eventually go away. And now they're unemployed or they're working as taxi drivers. So that's why when people say that they're sort of like this middle class in Afghanistan, particularly in Kabul, I don't really subscribe to that belief, because my understanding of a middle class is something that is somehow consistent over the generations, is able to be inherited. And this money is not consistent, because as soon as it went away, so did the lifestyles of so many people.
In 2013, the U.S. announced a plan to withdraw. What was the impact of that?
It was pretty immediate, you know, because you saw, you know, the other countries, the other NATO countries. So I think the first one was France. France started to withdraw. The UK started to withdraw. And so that immediately created less jobs and less opportunity for people. And then you saw slowly that foreign investment was getting less. And you saw that, you know, NGOs and media outlets were also starting to pull out. And these were all sources of income for people. And then from 2013 into 2014, it became the presidential election. And that led to a huge loss in potential economic investment. And in fact, Ashraf Ghani, who is now the president, when he was a candidate at the time, he said we lost a massive amount of potential wealth because these investors were waiting to see what would happen with the election. We're waiting to make sure that there was a proper democratic transition, to make sure that there wouldn't be another war, to make sure that it would be a president that they could trust. And so that in itself led to a huge economic pullback. And that created even more unemployment, to the point where now it's something like 40-45% of the population is unemployed.
And what about the authorities, the military, political leaders? What's their response been to, I mean, A, this unemployment, and also just the unrest that's been happening across the country?
Well, this is exactly what people are saying, is that everyone I've been talking to is saying that, how are they not able to take control of this situation? How are they not able to, you know, figure out what's going on and to try and stop this sort of unrest? So there's a real frustration among the people about what, you know, sorts of these officials are doing. Because the other thing we're seeing is that because after the election, John Kerry came and he orchestrated this so-called national unity government, which saw the number one and number two become president, and then the new office of the chief executive, which forced, I mean, imagine if Hillary Clinton hadn't conceded the election and she was forced to share the government in some way or another with Donald Trump, you know, her and her team. That's sort of the situation we've been in for the last 5 years. And so this is creating a situation where, you know, you have two rival teams trying to run the country. And then even within the teams of the president and the chief executive themselves, there are divisions and defections and, you know, people sitting in office right now within the administration criticizing this administration. And everyone laughs and is like, because they say the government is doing X. And we're like, well, you are the government.
Ali Latifi is a journalist in Kabul. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Museo Nacional de Antropología in Mexico City houses nearly 600,000 pieces of art and artifacts related to Mexico's history. Every year, millions of people visit the museum, which covers nearly 20 acres of land. In 1985, 124 objects were stolen from the museum, a massive heist seemingly carried out by a gang of expert criminals. But when authorities finally cracked the case 4 years later, it turned out that the culprits were two young, middle-class veterinary students. Sounds like something out of a movie, right? Director Alonso Ruiz Palacios thought so too, and his new movie, Museo, out tomorrow, is based off of this real-life heist. I spoke with Alonso along with the film star Gael Garcia Bernal, and we began by talking about what it's like to film inside the museum at the heart of this story.
I mean, it's a place that ever since you were a little kid, they take you there, and there is a tacit explanation that, you know, this place belongs to you. You know, you are part. You. This is where you come from, or this is who you are in a way, and it belongs to you. And so, just being there, shooting the movie, and feeling in touch with everything, it was that the same kind of sentence. You know, like, this belongs to us. This is something that belongs to everybody. This this is amazing, you know, and it was actually really, I don't know, very beautiful and even spiritual.
One of the things that the museum director told us when we were scouting and, you know, getting to know the whole museum was that there hadn't been any graffiti on the museum or the surrounding. There's a lot of graffiti in Mexico City, but the anthropology museum, the first time somebody spray painted one of the walls was, I don't know, like 2000 something. So, since it was built in the 60s, there's like this tacit understanding that it's up to the people of Mexico to look after it, and they really have. So that's part of the reason that the theft in 1985 was such a strong blow, you know, in the confidence of Mexicans, and it was like a slap in the face, you know.
And that's what I was going to ask you, is that there were, 124 different items that were stolen from the museum, and this feels like a collective cultural trauma almost.
Yes, it did. And at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, it's a myth. I mean, this theft, it, I think, has the quality of a myth in Mexico, because everyone has a different version of it. Mm. So, I mean, that became part of the DNA of the film as well, to embrace these contradictions and also like make our own version of this story.
And the kind of what added a mythical quality to this was the fact that the question that was planted was, why did they do it? Mm-hmm. Why did two kids do this? You know, it's something that the authorities, when this happened in Mexico, they didn't believe it was two kids. They thought it was going to be a huge gang of organized crime, you know, worldwide, you know, related to thefts in other parts of the world, in other museums and stuff. And not only that, they thought it must have been people from outside of Mexico. No, mm-hmm. not Mexicans, because yeah. no Mexican would ever do this. Mm. And so the trauma, the big shock was when they found out that it was two kids from a middle-class family from Mexico City that just did it, maybe just even for fun, straight after the earthquake, no? Like 2 months and a half after the 1985 earthquake, which was, I mean, shattered Mexico City. And so it was a horrible thing to feel. I mean, if I was my age back then, I mean, this age that I am back then, I think I would have felt a huge blow to my stomach, you know, like a spiritual, like, oh my God, no, this is like insult to injury. No?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, here's where it gets interesting. And of course, you touch on this in your film. These two kids, these guys, were stealing objects, and of course many museums have this history, right, that had already been taken away from communities. In many ways, museums represent the colonization of a people. So is it a loss to the heritage of the country? Is it a loss to the heritage of the indigenous people of Mexico? What would you think about that?
It's a really complicated question, because I think it doesn't have one straight answer. But I think the side that I was most excited by was looking at it like one of the Mexican intellectuals, Monsiváis, said when he was asked about the theft when it happened in 85. He said, I think this is a reminder that you don't know what you have until it's gone, you know? And I think there's something about the theft that did, if there's one positive thing that came out of that, was that people kind of turned to look at this place again and was like, we have this amazing museum, we have to look after it. And the museum, you know, it was created in 64, in this time in Mexico when they were looking to make a big statement about Mexican-ness and to redefine Mexican culture and reinforce it. So that has an upside and a downside. You know, the downside is the looting that has to take place to put all of that in one place. But I think the upside is there's also a line of that in the film that says there's no preservation without looting. And I think preservation and the continuance of memory is essential to a nation, to a country's identity. And I think that's what the museum was about. You know, nowadays we have our politicians, I think, they spend the money on something that that will only last for the term, you know, for 6 years, and they don't care what happens after that. And I think back then there was still this vision of like something that will last forever and something that will make Mexicans proud. And there's a legend when you come into the museum that says this museum is for Mexicans to look at themselves.
And of course, speaking of the history here, I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a fire that destroyed the majority of the collection in Brazil's National Museum. Given that your film is so close to and takes place in a museum, did you have any reactions to the cultural loss there or just, you know, the fire itself?
Yeah, it was shocking and really dramatic.
And Brazil has been going on through a huge, let's say, political hangover. Where this again is like, oh my God, not this also, you know, like now there is no compass to where to go, you know, or to point you the right direction to go.
But I think those things, like I was saying about the theft in Mexico, those traumatic events, they have to have some positive outcome, which is to make people pay attention, you know? Like, how can this happen? How can this had not been properly looked after with all the protocols about fire and all that? You know, it's a traumatic reminder that those things need looking after.
Alonso Ruiz Palacios is director of a new movie out this week called Museo, and Gael García Bernal is star of the film. Alonso, Gael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, and I wanted to let you know about something really important that's coming up. Next week, The Takeaway is traveling to Puerto Rico, 1 year after the landfall of another devastating storm, Hurricane Maria. And we'll be talking to students, farmers, community organizers, and others about their vision for the future of the island. Puerto Rico is at a crossroads, and we want to hear from you. If you're Puerto Rican, has your identity changed since Maria hit? And how do you think the island's relationship with the mainland United States has changed? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your stories, and be sure to tune in next week. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.